And we have this fantastic speaker here who is a Native American and is one of the most, well-known Native American lawyers in the country and probably around the world. John Echohawk is the executive director of the Native American Rights Fund, which he founded right out of law school in 1970. And so, John, this fund is a nonprofit law firm where they work for the Native American peoples and for indigenous peoples around the world, quite honestly. John has worked with and for the federal government, with state government. He's been on many councils and committees, and he's well known in Washington, D.C. I got to know John when I was in Washington, D.C., working on Indian matters. And he is not only such a nice gentleman, but he really knows his stuff. And he's agreed to talk to us today about Indian Reserve water rights. So with that, John, and he's giving us a break from PowerPoint. So I'm going to turn it over to you, John. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jennifer, and thanks for inviting me. I always take advantage of every opportunity to talk about tribes and Native Americans, because one of the most difficult issues that we face is that most people don't know anything about us. So one of the priorities of this organization is to take advantage of every opportunity to educate the public about tribes and about Native Americans, in particular law and policy issues. As you mentioned, helped to start the Native American Rights Fund 50 years ago. I was one of the co-founders, and it was really kind of a dream come true for me to be able to start working on these issues for our tribal people. I was born and raised in New Mexico, even though I'm a member of the Pawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. Lots of trips to Oklahoma, you know, always mixing with the relatives and the tribal members there. But again, being born and raised in New Mexico, I went to college there at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque on a scholarship to study political science. That was my pre-law major. I determined in high school I wanted to be a lawyer. I was really encouraged by my teachers to think about doing that. So that's what I set my sights on. I didn't have a scholarship to go to law school. I needed that financial aid, but I was in the right place at the right time again. The University of New Mexico Law School in 1967, when I graduated and was ready to start law school, received a grant from the Office of Economic Opportunity in Washington, D.C. That was the War on Poverty. And they figured one of the best things they could do to help Indian people was to try to get some professionals, because we had only a handful of lawyers and doctors. And they thought that would really help pull us out of poverty if we started getting into the profession. So they offered me a full ride scholarship to the law school there. And oh, sure, that's exactly what I needed. And so I started law school there, and to the credit of that faculty, they put together one of the first courses ever taught in any law school on federal Indian law. And I didn't know this stuff, very little about it. The other Native students who I started with, they didn't know anything much about it either. And we realized that our leaders didn't really know that. And as we found out about the legal profession, we basically saw that very few of our tribes had lawyers. Because, of course, lawyers cost money, and our people, our tribe, the poorest of the poor. So we didn't really have any lawyers. Part of the War on Poverty also was the establishment for the first time of legal aid offices for the poor, funded by the federal government. So poor people would have lawyers. and they put some of these legal aid offices on Indian reservations and sent all these young lawyers from Harvard and Yale out there to start representing these Indians. And they discovered this federal Indian law too. So they started bringing all of these great cases under the treaties and laws of the United States, which protect our rights. And we started studying those in law school and got to know these legal aid lawyers. And they basically brought me in as a summer law clerk, and I learned more and got more excited about that and saw the opportunities. And when I graduated from law school, I went to work for one of those organizations, the California Indian Legal Services Program. And as soon as I got there, they told me they had just received a grant from the Ford Foundation in New York City. The Ford Foundation had funded the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund to work on those civil rights issues of the greatest importance for the poor Black people and Mexican American people, because they didn't have lawyers either, and neither did we. So Ford said, "Well, let's start a program for the Indians." And this California Indian Legal Services was doing the best work in the country, they found out, so they gave them a grant. So as soon as I got out there, they asked me, the California Indian Legal Services people, "Do you want to help set up a National Indian Legal Defense Fund to serve tribes all over the?" Yes, uh-huh. I mean, that's, again, right place, right time. That's exactly what I wanted to do. So I helped them get started. We brought together Native leaders from around the country to serve as our board of directors, and they helped us identify the most important issues that we should be addressing in our legal representation, because, of course, there's no way we could represent everybody on everything. So we just set up some priority issues, and one of those issues was, Indian water rights, because most of our tribes are west of the Mississippi. It's dry out here, and unless you have rights to water, then you don't really have a future. And there were some issues going on at that time with tribes and water rights. So our all Native board said water rights is one of those issues. So we got involved in those issues. Under federal Indian law, tribes have reserved rights to water based upon a 1908 United States Supreme Court case, Winners against the United States. This is a case that came out of Montana involving the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation on the Milk River up there. And what had happened was the water they had been using started to be diverted by farmers upstream from them. And so they weren't getting the water that they had normally used. And so, the question became, okay, well, who's entitled to the water? And these farmers there on the Milk River had water rights under state law. And of course, the tribes, they didn't really kind of have anything settled yet, but they jumped in together with the federal government and started arguing that their reserve rights to water under their treaty and executive order predated those rights under state law. And this went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court looked at the treaties and executive orders and the law relating to Indians, which, of course, is all federal law. Tribes basically are units of government, sovereigns, treaties made between governments. And so in this country, there's tribal governments, state governments, and tribal governments. And so the Supreme Court looked at that and determined that when this relationship was developed between the federal government and the tribal government, that when the reservations were set aside, that even though the treaties or executive orders said nothing about water rights at all, that by implication, there was sufficient water reserved for those tribes for their present and future uses, with the priority date at least as early as the time the treaty or executive order set up the reservation. And of course, in most instances, that was before non-Indian settlement. And so the Supreme Court basically determined that the tribe's water right predated the water rights of those farmers under state law. And so the reserve water rights doctrine was established. The problem was, though, that federal Indian policy, you know, during that time was really kind of up in the air. The federal government had decided to try to force assimilation of tribes, and they were doing this primarily by breaking up the Indian reservations, and instead of the land being owned by the tribe, they started signing allotting parcels to individual Indians, and they became the landowners, and you know, they were hoping basically it'd become like white farmers, and you know, and pretty soon there wouldn't be any tribe any tribe left. And so this assimilation and allotment policy was going on. It was a policy that finally got stopped in 1934 when Congress passed the Indian Reorganization Act, and that was based upon data that they had been receiving over the last couple of decades before that, that this Indian allotment policy breaking up the reservations, not all of them were broken up, but a good number of them were, was basically not really helping the Indians. They were more poor than ever, and it was just a bad policy, and the Indians didn't like it, so they basically resumed recognizing the right of tribes to exist and govern their own affairs. So that started the Indian Reorganization Act revival. And that went on, unfortunately, just about 20 years, because in the 1950s, with the communist scare going on around the country, some people were thinking, well, the communal ways of Indians, that's bad, and we got to break up these tribes. So here we go again. This time they started terminating our tribes, basically abolishing our tribal governments, selling our land, shipping us to the cities. And they didn't ask us, they just did it. And this started to happen to a number of tribes across the country. And this happened to begin in the 1950s into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, with the civil rights movement going on, tribal activism started, and our people were protesting this termination policy, and finally got the attention of the Congress and the President of the United States. And in 1970, the president, at that time Richard Nixon, declared that this termination policy was wrong, and the tribes had a right to self-determination, a right to govern themselves as sovereign Indian nations, and this nation-to-nation relationship was going to be restored between the tribes and the federal government. So here we go again. We finally started being able to start moving forward with our development. And of course, that's the same year that the Native American Rights Fund was started. And again, we started addressing a number of issues, and some of those were these water issues. We started asserting the reserve water rights of tribes, with the assistance of the federal government, because the federal government also realized under federal Indian law that our lands and our waters are held in trust for us by the federal government. They have the title and we have the beneficial interest. They're basically our trustee. And of course, everybody knows trustees have fiduciary responsibilities. They're supposed to help the beneficiary, protect the beneficiary. And so we spent some time in Washington, D.C. educating the federal government, Justice Department, Interior Department, about federal Indian law and this federal trust responsibility that exists, because, you know, they're a trustee. They have our lands and resources in trust for us, so they're supposed to help us protect those resources. So they started working with us to file these water rights cases across the West, asserting the rights of tribes under these under the reserve rights doctrine, started by that Winters against United States case in 1908. Just incidentally, along the way in 1963, they had done that as part of a big case between the states of Arizona and California, arguing about the rights to water in the Colorado River. California, against Arizona. And it just so happened there's five Indian reservations located along the Colorado River. So in the process of that litigation, the federal government realized that, oh, I guess we got to help these tribes. So they asserted reserve rights for those five tribes along the Colorado River. And as part of that court decree by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1963, those five tribes received reserve water rights entitlements under that reserve rights doctrine. And the federal government realized that they needed to do more of that, not just for those tribes there, but just kind of go on offense and start filing these cases across the West. So they helped us do that. We started helping tribes, representing tribes together with the federal government and bringing these cases forward, and started to get the attention of the states, because the states started seeing that, of course, these claims were for reserve water rights for the tribes for present and future uses, with a priority date as early as the date that the reservation was established. And again, in most cases, that's going to predate the rights of water holders under state law. And so they started seeing, as tribes developed their water, maybe some of these state water rights users might be without water as the tribes move forward to use the water if they were decreed as a reserve right. So we started getting all kinds of calls and questions about that, and reactions from state attorney generals and Western governors and Western businesses who saw that maybe their business would be impacted by the assertion of these Indian reserve water rights in this litigation. And litigation, by the way, were really some of the largest cases in the West, because when these general stream adjudications were started by the tribes and the federal government, they basically required joinder of everyone asserting a right to water. And so everybody started getting joined into these cases, and just huge cases, probably decades to get done, but what had to be done had to be done. So it had started, and again, got the attention of the states. They contacted us, that the governors and the Western attorneys generals contacted the tribes and about this, and the tribes asked me to go with them and with some other lawyers to a big meeting we had in Denver in the early 1980s. And we all sat down and talked about this issue of these reserve water rights. And again, it was basically an opportunity to educate, the governors and the Western attorney generals about federal Indian law, winners against the United States, Indian reserve water rights, and just kind of went through the whole thing. And, with these Supreme Court cases backing us up, I mean, it looked like we had a pretty strong legal position, and they realized that and saw that these adjudications would basically last decades and kind of leave everything uncertain for a long period of time in terms of who owned the water, who had the water rights. And we started talking about alternatives to the litigation. And of course, the alternative is out of court settlement of these cases. And so they started thinking about that. And it just so happened at that time, one of the first cases that we had brought and helped with involving the Tohono O'odham tribe down in Arizona had negotiated a settlement, and that had gone through the Congress. It was the second one. The second Indian water rights settlement that had been through Congress. The first one had been a couple of years ago by the smaller Ok-Chin tribe in Arizona, but this one was a little bit larger. It's down by Tucson, so a lot of folks involved in that settlement. And it had gone through the Congress, and when it got to President Reagan's desk, he had vetoed it because of all this outrage over Indian water rights. And so, we all saw what was going on. So they said, well, what can we do? Well, You can help educate the president about the importance of settling these cases out of court. And here's one that ought to be settled. And so you ought to talk with him about it. So they did. And, you know, they made a few small tweaks in that law and then ran it back by the Congress and the president. This time he signed it because all the Western states and the governors and the attorney generals were encouraging President Reagan to sign this tribal water rights settlement. So we got it done. So they said, okay, well, let's do some more. How do we do this? Well, let's really get the federal government engaged here, the administration. So we all went to Washington, D.C. and met with the Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, and he didn't really know much about this, but as he sat down and talked with the governors and the Western Attorney Generals and tribal leaders and saw what was going on, that, oh, yeah, this is strange bedfellows, but this is something that the West, the Indians and the non-Indians in the West, are together on. We need to make this happen. So he helped to set up the Secretary of Interior's Indian Water Rights Settlement Office to get some staff together and start bringing people together to talk about these settlements, start facilitating settlements, negotiating settlements. And so so away we went. And that was in the, like I said, in the early 1980s. This was a process that really kind of caught on, kind of grew, and more negotiations, more settlements gradually, and it got to a point where we really had momentum. We have at the Native American Rights Fund been involved in 9 of the current 32 cases that have been settled by Congress, 32 tribal water rights settlements. We're currently involved in representing 6 tribes in those settlements. It's a process that's long and complicated, but basically when people out west sit down, Indians and non-Indians, they basically find a way to work together. Oftentimes, they've been bitter enemies, but as they sit down and start talking about, okay, well, we've got to learn how to use this water in this basin in a fair and equitable way, then, and again, the tribes with basically very good legal position, they have to be talked to and they have to be dealt with. And these negotiations usually work. It's the formula as president, a lot of these settlements, they're all unique, they're all different, but common features are that basically tribes kind of give up some of the water that they could have claimed. They just go out of their way to try to take care of the existing non-Indian uses, try to find a way where everybody can live together, nobody gets shortchanged. Tribes, for the most part, hadn't been able to use all the water they were entitled to, as they're entitled to develop for future uses, but they've always had difficulty getting the money to do that. So the thing that's in there for the tribes is not only do they get some water rights reserved established, but they also get the funding to be able to utilize that water and then get paid for the water that they give up. And so, as you can see, we're talking about money, and in lots of these cases, big money, millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, some of them approaching $1 billion. And as you can imagine, in Washington, these budget issues, they don't go over very, very easily. It's always a difficult issue trying to get the funding necessary for these tribal water rights settlements. When he first started, they kind of said, oh, well, us people in D.C., what we'll do is we'll just take this money out of the Bureau of Indian Affairs budget. Well, I'm sorry to say that budget is inadequate to start with, trying to fund, all kinds of tribal programs promised under the treaties, education, economic development, on and on and on. The money's just really deficient there. We, never done very well on appropriations because we're a relatively small population, and so we don't have a whole lot of political power, and so we've always really done bad on appropriations and trying to take money that is already short and spend it on these tribal water rights settlements was just wrong. And so we held out against that. No way are we going to take this money out of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. It had to come out of other federal programs. That, of course, the Bureau of Indian Affairs is an interior, so immediately started looking at other interior programs. Okay, well, you know, here's the interior budget, here's the interior money. Where, you know, where can we find other money outside of BIA for these settlements? And of course, that's a difficult problem, a difficult issue. We, of course, suggested early on, well, how about the Bureau of Reclamation? Because, of course, the reclamation law set up in the early 1900s. I mean, that was basically to develop Western water projects, you know, taking, you know, federal monies and, using that to develop water. And that had been done under all kinds of reclamation projects. It benefited non-Indians for the most part. And so, hey, how about some of that going to these tribal water rights settlements? And, oh, we had a big backlash when we started talking about accessing reclamation funds for Indian water rights settlements. But finally, after years and years of effort, people started finally seeing that, yeah, this is really something that needs to be done. One of the things that really helped us was a 1973 report from what they call the National Water Commission. And they kind of studied all these Western water issues. And in one chapter, they basically said, one of the sorriest chapters in the history of the West is how tribes have been shortchanged on their water rights and their water claims and their water needs. So we always cited that report every time. And people finally started seeing, oh, yeah, yeah, the non-Indians got the benefit of all of the water development money, but the Indians didn't get anything. And that's wrong. That's just wrong. And then, of course, with the litigation going on, and more of the state leaders started saying, yes, that's right. That's right. We need to basically start looking to the Bureau of Reclamation for some of the funding. So that finally helped. So that's one of the things that helped with that funding issue that we faced in each one of these settlements. Over the years, we've had different kinds of issues come up relating to that. Of course, there's always just the regular, budget issues. And part of what we did was come together with the states and go over to the Office of Management and Budget there in Washington, D.C., that, kind of manages that budget for the administration. And we spent a lot of time, regular meetings with them, trying to educate them about these issues. But it's really a difficult job, as Jennifer knows, because I think she helped us at some of those meetings. It's a tough go, but dealing with that Office of Management and Budget, also dealing with the congressional committees as well that deal with this on the Senate and House side is always difficult. But we've always been able to count on support from the Western Governors Association here. Most recently, they just kind of turned everything over to the Western States Water Council. The Western States Water Council is made up of all the Western state water directors, and they know how important these issues are. And so they've always worked with us on promoting these tribal water rights settlements. And since the early 1990s, we've had symposiums on these Indian water rights settlement issues, bringing together all of the federal, state, and tribal and private parties involved in these settlements. We've been meeting every 2 years to kind of see how each session of Congress goes in terms of dealing with these issues. We bring all the players in. You know, we spend 2 days talking about these issues, which settlements got done, how they get done, what's pending, what's coming up, how can we move these pending settlements forward. And that that process just continued. That gives us the opportunity to talk about these budget issues that come up. Two of them here fairly recently has been what they call earmarks. the House of Representatives said no more earmarks, you know, with specific funding for specific state projects. And when you do that, then that's not going to make it through the budget process. And we tried to explain, well, this is a federal national obligation. It's not a state obligation. But that argument didn't carry the day. So we were dead in the water there for a couple of years because of this earmark problem we had. And trying to get around that. And finally, got a little nudge there because they finally said, well, if the administration supports it, then we'll say it's not an earmark. Well, of course, most of the time the administration doesn't support these settlements, and a good part of the time we have to go around the administration, go to our congressional delegations in the Senate and the House, and get them to see the wisdom of passing these settlements, even though administration officials oppose it, and pass it that way. So that doesn't always work for us either. So we're always, again, dealing with all these different kinds of variations on these water rights settlements. It's really kind of a continuing process. As I mentioned, we're representing six tribes right now on their water rights claims. We're representing the Kickapoo tribe in Kansas that has negotiated a settlement with the state of Kansas in principle. But again, to implement the settlement, they need a project that would basically bring water to the reservation. That requires a dam on a river, and of course that's funding, and they just haven't been able to get it. So we're trying a different tack there by seeing if we can't get funding from the Department of Agriculture to do that. So we've got agriculture interested, so they're in the mix. So maybe that'll go. And again, it's pending right now in Washington, D.C. We've also been involved in representing the trying to think of the name of the tribe right now, down in Palm Springs, California, the Agua Caliente Band of Cahuilla Indians. And, of course, Palm Springs, that's their Aboriginal territory. That's why they were located there. Those springs are there, not much to water in the desert. And that's, of course, why Palm Springs grew up there, because, you know, there's water in those springs. And so that place has really grown. But the tribe's been there. They have land there, and of course water rights. It's all groundwater, and they've been concerned about how things are going with the use of the groundwater. The water table is dropping, and in addition to that, the water districts have brought in water from the Colorado River, but it's not treated, and basically it's starting to pollute the existing groundwater supply. So the tribes have been very concerned there and asserted rights to reserve rights to groundwater to be involved in those issues. And it went up through the district court of appeals. They ruled reserve water rights include rights to groundwater for the tribe. And the Supreme Court denied cert. So, we're basically in negotiations now with the people out in Palm Springs, those water districts, so trying to figure out our groundwater rights for those that Agua Caliente band of Mission Indians there. We've got two settlements out in one settlement out in California. We're working to implement. That's the San Luis Rey settlement, involving five tribes along the San Luis Rey in Southern California. We're also representing the Tule River tribe in California. They basically, like the Kickapoo tribe in Kansas, negotiated a local water settlement, an agreement among the water users there about how to implement that settlement. But for the tribe's part to come through, again, they need a dam. They need a diversion project to be able to divert that water for use on the reservation. Having a hard time getting the money for that project, but they're still at it, and we're still negotiating with Interior, and hopefully we can get something they'll support, Congress will support, and get that through. Up in Northern California, Southern Oregon, we've been involved for years representing the Klamath tribes of Oregon and the assertion of their water rights. They basically have rights to maintain the fishery that they've depended on since time immemorial. And we were able to establish that the tribes have that right to water to maintain those fish in Klamath Lake there. And of course, then that limits how much water could be taken out of the lake and used elsewhere. Some of that water is used by farmers locally below the lake, and they're always trying to use more and more water, and we're trying to retain it for the tribes. And these issues have been going on for decades, and the tribes have the senior rights. We've been at it. We've been representing them for decades, all kinds of litigation, on and on and on, through the federal courts and the state courts, and so it just really goes on and on. It's complicated by the fact that Klamath River goes all the way down from Oregon through California. There's a number of California tribes down there that also depend on that water to maintain their fishing rights. So we've been close to a settlement a time or two in that process, but so far no Klamath River Basin settlement. But again, we're really working hard on it. And right now there's a promising development there. Maybe some of the dams along that river can be taken out, and that would really help sustain the fishery. And we're really close to getting that done for all those tribes there along the Klamath River. And then finally, up in Idaho, for the Nez Perce tribe, we have represented them in years past on their tribal water rights claims to the Clearwater River. Big negotiation there, and it finally got settled, and so that part of it's done. And now there's an adjudication on the Palouse River, which is also a part of the reservation. So that process is starting. But since we've been through that with all the parties up there before, we're pretty optimistic we're going to be able to reach a settlement once all the claims get defined, and we start working with each other on that. We're hopeful that we can find a settlement there, but again, there's probably going to be some funding involved, and then we'll hit that big funding issue again. That's kind of what happens.
So, John, can I interrupt you here?
Sure.
You have done a great job of the law, the policy, and the politics that goes into these settlements. And I think it's important that we emphasize that the Native American tribes are giving up a lot of what they would be due under the reserve water rights doctrine for several reasons. One is to help get some money into the tribe to promote their development. And the other one, the main one, I think, and John talked about it, is to live with their neighbors. And that's very important to them. And I also want to mention here, John, that I want to go to Daryl Vigil's statement about when you know one Indian tribe, you know one Indian tribe. Mm-hmm. Every tribe, every pueblo is unique, which makes it even more of a challenge as John and his folks and people working on these settlements or in front of the courts to work at it. So it's those are some really important points. And John, is it okay if we go ahead to questions, or is there some more that you want to mention?
I was just going to summarize very quickly the other cases pending up in Washington right now. I already mentioned our Kansas Kickapoo case that's pending. There's also this settlement between the Navajo Nation and the state of Utah that you and I talked about earlier, Jennifer. This is on the Colorado River, San Juan River, there in southeastern Utah, and that's been in negotiations for a long time, and they got a settlement together and just about done. Again, several hundred million dollars, as part of that. And So that's pending. We've also got an amendment to a New Mexico settlement involving some of the Pueblos there around Santa Fe. This is a case that been going on forever. It started when I was in law school 50-something years ago, and it finally got resolved here, I think about 8 or 10 years ago, and they started implementing that, but they found out basically that there were a few issues that they didn't quite scope out financially well enough, and they don't have enough money in the settlement to see the settlement through, so everything stopped. So they need more funding to finish that settlement off. And so that is pending as well. And then finally, the largest settlement of all, over $1 billion, coming down from Montana, the Salish and Kootenai tribes on the Flathead Indian Reservation, won a settlement. It's a huge, beautiful reservation. These water rights issues have been in contention for decades. They finally reached a settlement up there with the state of Montana, and their delegation introduced the bill, and it's basically kind of been approved up there and kind of been pending in Washington. So that's pending as well. Montana is a special case there. Early on, the state officials up there with those seven tribes in their state recognized this problem and set up a reserved water rights settlement commission. And they have basically settled out with all of those tribes except for two. They didn't mess around with litigation. They just went right to settlement, and really kind of a good example for states to follow. And they finally got the big one done here, this settlement. Now it's pending in Washington. So we've got those four up there. And I was telling Jennifer too earlier when we were talking, it's more often than not that these tribal water rights settlements do not get approved until right at the very end of the Congress, what they call a lame duck session. You know, Congress messes around for 2 years and they never kind of get all the stuff done that they should get done. And then right after the election, you know, they go back into session. They call it the lame duck session. And so they finally get down to business and do the stuff that they should have done a long time ago. That's the way a lot of these water rights settlements finally get done. People come together and realize, yeah, these things really need to get done. So let's set aside all the politics and just do it. And we're hoping that that's going to happen here with these water rights settlements again here after the election before this Congress adjourns at the end of December. So with that, Jennifer, let me open it up for questions.
That's great. And first, to everyone who's joining us, I want to give our students the opportunity first to ask questions and see if anybody has some questions. And Natalie, I think you and I were talking about the Ute tribes in Colorado. And I didn't know if that sparked any questions in your mind that you might want to ask, John.
Oh, when we were talking about that, that was to be built into an undergraduate class. And I think we have figured out that. But I do have a question, actually. Mm-hmm. When you were talking, you had mentioned some issues surrounding water quality. And I was wondering if you could kind of elaborate on how that gets incorporated into settlements and like these negotiations a little bit.
That's an issue that's usually left aside, the water quality issues. That's basically environmental law. That's a different creature than quantity issues. How much water, that's included in a reserve right to water. So these are kind of water rights and not water quality. That's a whole nother thing. We're not involved in that issue ourselves. But those are basically issues that are dealt with separately. And then that mention of the Colorado Utes, that's one of the nine cases that we worked on. We represented the Ute Mountain Ute and Southern Ute in their water rights negotiations that went on and on and finally got settled through the Colorado Ute water settlement. And just like that New Mexico settlement I mentioned, they started implementing that, and then some issues came up that they hadn't quite dealt with adequately in the first settlement, and so it had to be amended, and that took a couple years to finally get that through. But all that's done now and finally being implemented.
And we have a new reservoir out of that too.
Yes, uh-huh, the Ben Nighthorse Campbell Reservoir. Yes.
Nighthorse Campbell Reservoir, that's right. Yeah. Any of the other students have questions for John? Johanna, go ahead.
I guess this is a little slightly off topic, but something that I'm also interested in, we're doing kind of a group project about looking at prescriptive burns versus forest fires versus kind of cultural burns. And I was looking into that a little bit, and there was argument that a lot of the kind of Native American cultural burns also kind of provides for water, like better water ecosystems, and for water to come back more, especially in kind of drought prone areas like California. Have you guys worked on that kind of subject before in terms of kind of representation for Native Americans who want to maintain their land?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the question is, but I think it might relate to climate issues.
Climate issues and like the right to conduct like cultural burning.
Well, that's kind of a sovereignty issue, jurisdiction issue, and you know, it's the tribe's land, and they can do what they want to, and you know, they use these cultural practices they traditionally used, you know, on their lands. Yeah, sure, that's okay. But that's not the, you know, in this water rights issue we're talking about. But you did mention climate, and I think that's something that's really impacting the magnitude of the forest fires we have going on right now. But climate change, it's an issue in these water rights negotiations too, because, you know, we have to come up, you know, working with our experts, how much water is the tribes going to be needed, you know, for present and future uses. And, you know, and then negotiate that out with our state partners and things. And, you know, we're trying to figure, okay, well, how much water do we have to divide up? And of course, with climate change, those forecasts are not good. And basically, we're kind of looking at not as much water being around in the future as we have now. And so that enters into all these discussions and negotiations as well. You know, trying to factor in, okay, what are we going to have in the future, and who's going to get what? And this climate change issue really makes that complicated.
So John, Reagan has passed along a question. First, thanking you for coming and talking to us, and wants to know if you'd like to comment on the Standing Rock Sioux struggle over the Dakota Access Pipeline. And why didn't the claim of tribal sovereignty over the surface and groundwater prevail? And was a precedent set with respect to that?
Well, it's not really an issue in the case. You know, tribal water rights are not really at stake there in terms of the entitlement of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. The concern there is that if there's a break in the pipeline, then the water that the tribe depends on right there in the lake, next to the reservation, right below, you know, where the pipeline crosses the river, but that's basically going to pollute their only source of water. And so that's really the concern. Nobody's contesting the fact that contesting that the tribes have the right to use this water, you know, in the lake that's right by the reservation. Nobody's contesting that. But they're just kind of saying, oh, there's not going to be a pipeline break, so you don't have to worry. You're always going to be able to have clean water. And, you know, sure. And that basically is the issue, that environmental issue and the danger that poses.
Yeah, those are always famous last words, right? It's never going to break. Mm-hmm. Another question, at the tribal national level, who oversees water use and maintenance? And administration of water rights, actually.
Uh, Well, it will basically be court decrees is what implements these negotiated tribal water rights settlements. It's all incorporated into the court decrees, and so the court administers those decrees accordingly. And we've talked about the funding that comes, and of course the federal government's got to follow through on the funding provided in the settlements, and that's usually Interior and Reclamation and those agencies. So really two things there.
Yeah, and you had mentioned about with respect to the funding. I want to let people know too that states feel that these settlements are important enough that they usually throw some money at this also or contribute to it. Unfortunately, states are just as strapped as everyone else, but that I thought was a really important sign as you start doing these settlements to see the states say, we think this is important enough to spend some of our funds on.
Yes, the states have to make a contribution to the settlement as well. Yes.
Yeah. And so the politics of this, John, is you get the state and the tribes together, some of the stakeholders, you come up with a settlement. You always want the federal government there ahead of time, but that never seems to quite work. Mostly just because of resources, et cetera. And then you talked about going around the administration straight to senators and congressmen. And that's been my experience. And of course, you have way more than I do with respect to this, but that does add a bit of politics to it. And how do you educate these people on why this is important for the federal government? What do you say?
Well, just like what we've done here, we just kind of explain the Indian Reserve Water Rights Doctrine, winners against the United States, Arizona against California, the treaty relationships that exist, the government-to-government relationship found in the Constitution, and the trust responsibility, the fact that, our lands and waters are held in trust for us by the federal government, and government's got a fiduciary obligation to help us protect that and use it. And again, it's just an education process, talking to them about things that they don't really know anything about. And like I said, we're regular visitors to Washington, meeting with all the people involved in this process together with, again, the Western States Water Council. They're there with us, and it's kind of letting them know this is a very important Western water issue. We're together on this as Westerners. We need to get this done. This is a national obligation because of the trust responsibility, and we have to get this done. It's really important to the future of the West and, the economy and the certainty. And it's just a never-ending education process, and people are always changing up there, different senators and congressmen and staffers and people over at the White House and Office of Management Budget, people over there at Interior, that changes as well. And, it's just musical chairs all the time. So we've got to be up there all the time educating people.
I had to come out of the dark here. That's good. And that kind of segues to another question I had, and actually somebody else brought it up, and that is the Colorado River. And you had mentioned Arizona v. California, and that did settle some of the tribes' rights. But there's still quite a few tribes that have not resolved or settled or had determined their reserve water rights. What needs to be done on the Colorado River? I mean, it's the states and the federal government did a lot of negotiating on the river here a few years ago, and the tribes were not involved. And finally, the tribes have gotten involved. And so I think that's helping us inform us what's going on, but there's still quite a few out there. Do you have any words of wisdom on how we navigate that?
Not really. It's just this political process I was talking about, and that cuts both ways and changing all the time. And, you know, we just have to keep doing the best we can to, try to move those issues forward on that. We don't represent any of those tribes down in that area right now, so I'm not directly involved, but of course, try to work with the tribes and their attorneys on that and keep up with it as best I can. But it's, a continual ongoing process, and, you know, we just have to, be constant, be vigilant, and just keep going. We've got altogether about 20 sets of negotiations going on right now that's being managed out of the Secretary's Indian Water Rights Office. And, and there are other tribes that are kind of lined up there waiting for their turn, trying to get them a federal negotiating team to get their negotiations started. And, of course, a lot of the politics come in there, okay, what are we going to do next? And do we really want to sit down and negotiate with these guys? And, ongoing, continual process. And, of course, one of the big ones there in the Colorado River, I think, as everybody knows, is the Navajo Nation, and their reserve water rights there in Arizona are still unresolved and haven't been brought. And, and there's litigation pending in the Ninth Circuit right now about that. So how come the federal government hasn't helped the Navajo Nation assert their reserve water rights in Arizona? So it's before the Ninth Circuit now, whether the government's got an obligation to do that or not.
Anybody else now that would like to ask John questions? I know we're a little bit over, but we can take maybe a couple more minutes. If you have questions, just kind of unmute yourself and ask them.
Hi, this is Rio de la Vista.
Hi, Rio.
Hi. Thank you so much for this really, really informative talk. And I'm wondering if there's resources that you might steer us to if we want to help educate our elected officials on tribal water rights and learn more for ourselves, because it's I live on the Rio Grande, and we don't have any here in Colorado, but certainly downriver we do. And it's something I want to, I'm working on water education at Adams State University, and I want to bring these perspectives to our future water leaders, as well as the current water, current elected leaders.
Mm-hmm. Well, any books about federal Indian law, of course, are always going to have something about Indian reserve water rights in there. So that's, all these legal books are one source. Or two, you can access our website at the Native American Rights Fund, narf.org, narf.org. And of course, we've got all kinds of stuff on our website about all of these Indian law issues. And part of that, of course, is the water rights issues. You just get on our website and look up what we do. And of course, we do a lot of stuff, but you look under natural resources. And when you look into that, then you see a segment on water rights. And so look at that, and lets you get access to all of the information that we develop for these symposiums on Indian water rights issues that we have every 2 years with the Western States Water Council. And we always have great presentations by everybody involved in these issues on that. And it's really a great resource if you want to learn about Indian water rights.
Great. I will definitely look at that. Thank you.
Okay.
And that was, again, John, narf.org.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anybody else have questions out there? All right. Well, John, that was excellent. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. And you did such a good job. I'll probably be calling on you again. But this is just such a treat to have somebody with your kind of experience and to talk about just the process. And you have to be just persistent. And Native Americans are persistent, and you have to be. So I want to thank you for taking the time with us today. And we can, if anybody would like to follow up with you on questions, I think you're going through the website is the way to do it. And so thanks, John. I really appreciate the time. And thank you all for joining us. Next week, we have the head of Denver Water, Jim Lockhead. His name escaped me for just a second. He talked about Colorado River issues. Jim has done a lot of work on the Colorado River, as well as his municipal work for Denver Water. So we're looking forward to that. So thank you all and have a good evening. And John, bless you.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you.